I was born on the 17th of November, 1964. I grew up in a place called Gartnamona for the first 10 years of my life. And then we moved to a place called Palace Lake, and one was down the road from the other.
Offaly-born Marina Carr has had over a dozen of her plays professionally produced. She grew up steeped in a rural landscape.
The lake was very present from very early on. In the first house, you were looking onto the back of the lake. And in the second house, you were on the shore of the lake. And across the lake, you could see the Schlieffblom Mountains.
The dramatic landscape was more than just a physical presence.
There were all sorts of legends and stories around the lake. And there was a story in the family, or from the neighbours, that was told about the witch with the 7 drops of water in her pouch. And she dropped one and it became the lake. And there were all kinds of stuff like that. And I remember this huge pike being caught in the lake. And years later, I'd be describing this to people, and they said, you know, there's never been a pike that size caught in the world, not to mind in your little lake. But I suppose it was perspective for a small child stretched, this huge pike stretched out. It just looked monstrous.
Homegrown theatre was also a part of the future playwright's domain.
Writing was big in our house. We had our own little theatre and we wrote plays. My brother wrote plays and I wrote plays and my sister wrote plays and we all acted in them. We invited the neighbourhood in and we had a little sweet shop and we had a bicycle lamp onto the stage and with the stage made with plywood on top of the turf that was stacked for the winter. And we had a curtain. We had the whole shebang with seats. And our performances were usually on Saturday, and we had elaborate costumes, which consisted mainly of nylons over our faces, weird hats and black rubbish bags, whatever else you can find. I don't remember the narrative, but I remember our themes were brutal. Everyone was being hung and quartered and savaged, and everyone was both the perpetrator of the crime and the innocent victim. If you can understand that. I suppose children are always guilty and innocent. You're really trying to figure out the world for yourself. So you go through the most brutal tortures, and you know, with the wheel and with the rack and we had the barrel of oil, you know, the boiling oil. And then we'd all come out and we'd all apologise for the crimes and somehow get off and we'd take our bow. But actually, if you think about it, our narratives were very Shakespearean. I'm not saying the dialogue was anywhere approaching Shakespearean, but the narrative was. If you read the Shakespeare plays or any of the Greek plays, it's all violence and, you know, people pushed to the edge and pushed to the very limit, and where the innocent becomes the doer and back again. And there doesn't seem to be this linear morality, which is somehow very prevalent in this millennium, you know, that you're either guilty or innocent.
Carr attended secondary school first in Tullamore and then in Mount Mellick before moving on to third level education.
I went to UCD in 1987. They say I read English and philosophy these days. I would say I studied English and philosophy. Most kids of 17 don't know what they want to do. I ended up doing an arts degree and was very lucky to be doing an arts degree because I didn't study for my Leaving Cert. The university experience, I think, is it's a big change for a girl coming up from the country or a young boy coming up from the country and dealing with the city and dealing with not living at home and trying to organise your life. I mean, all the things you have to take care of that have all been done for you until then took up most of my energy. So it was about a year before I figured out what I was actually doing at UCD. And then I did figure it out and started to attend my lectures and started to read what I needed to read and read all around. I mean, I'd always been a good reader from 15 onwards. But to have guidance and people who know what they're talking about discussing work with you, the seminars and pointing in different directions is hugely helpful.
And there was one writer whose work was read particularly closely.
Beckett was a huge discovery for me. I discovered him late. I'd seen the documentary when he died. The nuns in Mount Mellick had kept us up late to watch this fantastic documentary the week he died when I was doing my Leaving Cert, our fifth year. So I'd heard about him, but that was all I knew about him. But in third year in UCD, there was a lot of Beckett, a lot of modern drama was covered, and Beckett was the one for me. I thought he was extraordinary, and prompted me to start writing my first, what I would call, mature play, although mature is probably not the correct, but first adult play.
Carr's first written play was Ulalu, but it was not produced immediately. That honour went to Low in the Dark, which was produced by the Project Arts Centre and Crooked Sixpence Theatre Company in 1989. Sarah Jane Skiff played Binder.
The characters involved were Bender, who was Joan Brosnan Walsh. She was my mother, and her area was in the bathroom. She used to lie in the bath all the time, drinking and smoking and having and feeding babies constantly. My part was Binder, her daughter, and my area was mostly the toilet of the bathroom and on top of the toilet, looking out the window and in general playing around in the bathroom and finding babies for her in the shower where she had thrown them earlier on so that she could feed them again. Then there was the other side of the stage was the guy's side of the stage, and Baxter, and who was Peter Holmes, and Bone, who was played by Dermot Moore, that was their side of the stage. They were constantly involved in building a wall. And then we had Breed Vicari, who played Curtains. She was kind of this character that told a story all the way through the play about men and women and life. And in fact, the title of the play comes from that story. She's talking about the man who was from the north and the woman who was from the south. And they had become like two people anywhere. And she describes them walking low in the dark through a dead universe. And that's where the title of the play comes from.
I wrote Ulalu while I was in college, but it wasn't performed until after Low in the Dark, which was the second play I wrote. Ulalu comes from the old Irish word, which means death song. And it was the chant they used to sing around the corpse when they were laying it out or when at the wake. And you had a foot chorus and a head chorus and two side choruses. In terms of what it was about two characters, Tilly and Tomrid. Tomrid, who was played by Mark Lambert, was trying to grow the longest toenails in the world, and Tilly, who was played by Alwyn Fowere, was trying to achieve nothingness. So it came directly out of my reading of Beckett and my worship of his work. So it was absurdist. Tilly was in the bed refusing to get out of it because she was trying to achieve nothingness, and her husband Tomrid is in the chair and he can't move because he's growing his longest toenails, and if he moves they'll break. So there was all kinds of negotiations and battles going on.
With Ulalu, I was very aware of her very anarchic sense of humour.
Alwyn Fowere played Tilly in the 1991 Peacock Theatre production of Ulalu.
It was essentially the humour and her grasp of the female-male relationship that was really interesting in that. And the fact that she confined us physically in particular ways, which came from her Beckettian influence. But the exchanges between them, to me, seemed to come out of the fact that they were stuck in this place together. And then you start to get hints of their history and hints of losses, possibly a loss of children or whatever. She was always in a nightie and she had one stiletto shoe on and one stiletto shoe off. And I also remember there was references to wedding or... Anyway, that is something that seems to come back a lot in the work that I've done with Marina, is this wedding thing.
The two subsequent plays I wrote after Ulalu and Low in the Dark were This Love Thing and The Dear Surrender. And as far as I'm concerned, they were absolute disasters. And it was a very difficult time in my life, and I realised I needed to head off somewhere and think about what I was doing. I'm not a child anymore. If you're going to be a writer, you know, stop messing around. So I headed off to the west of Ireland for a year and a half and did very little else except read and write. And The May came out of that, but it came slowly and it came very hard.
The May, I think it was written for me. Marina has said to me at the time it was written for me. She said that about a number of plays she's written. So we have this joke that she's my playwright and that I'm her actor. The May was, you first see her in an embrace with her husband, who's a cellist, who's come back from yet another of his tours, one assumes. But very quickly, you start to see that she's in this house, which she has built very much for Robert, her husband. There's a whole part of her which is trying to transcend, I suppose, her environment and the whole social confines that she's in. In another way, she's not aware of the social confines because she's completely adopted them and she's completely aspiring to be all the things that, you know, an aspiring middle class person in the Midland would hope to be. So she's built this house around her, which is like this kind of structure which confines her. But at the same time, she's aspiring to transcend it in some sort of way. And she does that completely through her relationship with Robert, that is her portal to another dimension. It's almost like she's an artist, but had no other channel apart from through this relationship.
The character of Robert, the sole man in the play, he's a cellist. Music permeated the play. I love music in theatre. I think it's so evocative, and it says, you know, it says in a phrase, what it takes three pages of dialogue. You know, it's a great mood creator, and there's something so powerful about music and language together, if it's got right. You see it in film all the time. Underscoring is such an art form, and I think that's another thing we have to learn in the theatre, how to underscore language. Because we're at, I suppose, as a civilization, we're almost talked out. Our attention is very easily taken. It's almost as if language is not enough for us anymore. We need all the senses fulfilled, and music certainly fulfills a lot of them.
I played the title role in Portia Coughlin in the 1996 production at the Peacock Theatre, and it was, of course, the first time that the play had been performed.
Actress Dervla Crotty.
Almost always when I go on to a new stage, I find myself saying some words from Portia, and it's a personal ritual at this stage. I suppose that choice of words and saying haunting really encapsulates something about Portia, where I think every character is haunted by their landscape, of course, by those that they have left, or their own selves, really, their past selves, crying back at them. In Portia, I think, everything has already happened. So when we open, it's Portia's 30th birthday, and it's exactly 15 years from the death by suicide of her brother Gabriel, who is her twin brother. And in the course of the play, certain truths are told and there are certain contradictions. So really, you make up your own mind what is the truth. But we can imagine that Portia has made a suicide pact with him and at the last moment decided to live and decided to free herself really from the grasp of this brother and this particular love and close and most certainly incestuous relationship. It's the most extraordinary world, I think, that she created. Marina wrote it in a very particular dialect, so by paying very close attention to that, we all managed to sound like we were from the same family, or certainly from the same place. And we went further in that in finding a certain musical landscape. I think to some extent we sang the words, I mean, and of course not in a sing-songy way, but, you know, to really get your mouth around those particular very strong sounds, there was a natural musicality. And really that's down to Gary Hines, who directed, and Marina, of course.
Portia Coughlin was the beginning of, or a furthering of, my attempt to explore language and how it's spoken and how language creates character. I'd written the main standard English and I felt I'd got a certain part of the way with the May, but knew there was far, you know, much further, much longer path beginning to be laid out. I'm not exactly sure how, but I just heard these voices and I heard this sound. And it is. It is very. It's remarkably like the sound of the way I spoke as a child, and the way all my neighbours and people I knew growing up spoke in that small area of County Offaly. But it's also more than that. I'd never had any interest in nailing a precise location, geographical location. That they're, you know, they call them, you know, Midland, that they're set in the Midland. As far as I'm concerned, they could be set on Mars. You know, that these people are, they're in no way indicative of the neighbours I knew growing up or the people I knew or anything like that. It is more an artistic journey or a stop on the road for me.
One of the most exciting developments in the Irish theatre, and certainly in the Abbey in the 90s, I took over the Abbey at the end of 93 from Gary Hines.
Former artistic director of the Abbey, Patrick Mason.
And in that first season, 94, we produced The May. Also in my time at the Abbey, several years later, I commissioned and directed The Bog of Cats. But on a scale, I mean, we talked from the first about, well, you know, maybe The May went on to The Peacock on the smaller space, but saying, look, maybe, you know, it's time to open up. Maybe we should just try something on a bigger scale, take advantage of the other things that you know, scale can give you. And turning, as she did, to, and she's always had this fascination with Greek theatre and this idea of the Medea, the woman who kills her children to spite the lover, husband, whatever. Extraordinarily transmogrified and transformed into the Bog of Cats. A wonderful sense of the almost grotesque, what I call the Gothic, these strange characters, like the cat woman and haunting the bog. But the sheer force of the play, who else, you know, would do a wedding scene which ended up with three wedding dresses on stage? I mean, it's just kind of brilliant coup de théâtre, you know, that you end up with three wedding dresses on stage. And it's just the daring of that and the freshness of that image, you know, the terrible destruction of the play at the end. And I thought, you know, the sheer courage to take on, I mean, those actions of such, you know, emotional immensity. I mean, we are kind of talking Greek, you know, and we don't see our lives as being very Greek at the moment in that sense. And here was Marina stepping up to the block and saying, no, you know, there are these great tragic actions that still take place.
In the centre of Raftery's Hill is the father, which I played.
Tom Hickey played Red Raftery in On Raftery's Hill, which was co-produced by Druid and the Royal Court Theatre in May 2000.
To say the least, he's not a sympathetic character. For people who haven't seen the play, at the end of the first half of the play, he rapes the youngest daughter. And the extraordinary thing is that when this character and his friend entered in the second half of the play, there was a scene where we got laughs. So this is an extraordinary situation that she could write this savage, dark man who had a sense of humour. It was a severe challenge, but I had the assistance of Gary Hines, who was very, very helpful. At the end of the first half, Red rapes the youngest daughter, whom he has never touched, by the way, up to this point. Now, in the house, while this is going on, there is another, the elder sister, whom he has abused, of course, and there is a granny. Gary's question in rehearsal was, how could they, knowing this was going on, allow it to happen? And finally Marina said, well, I thought it was a most profound reply. Well, she said, Marina said, maybe it was just her turn. And I found that profoundly black answer, but that was it. Maybe it's her turn.
And Raftery's Hill was written around the same time as Portia Cochlea, strangely enough, and was produced after by The Bog of Cats. So the chronology is a bit off. It's also in the idiom. I was reading a lot of Greek plays at the time. So I think this is actually my most Greek play, strangely enough. in terms of repetition down the generations and some crime, some hidden crime going on, or some, and how that is dealt with within the hothouse of the family. It's basically about incest going down through several generations and the suffering and turmoil and insanity that is produced in an enclosed household because of this, where all of the relationships are turned upside down. Daughters behaving like wives and mothers behaving like daughters, and fathers and sons gone crazy and just everyone out of their minds with grief and terror and suffering, and nobody entering in and attempting to sort out this situation. Perhaps it's beyond attempts of sorting out, it's beyond sorting out, really. It's almost like this, there's a fate and a destiny I wanted to explore. And coming through, I suppose it comes through in Raftery's Hale, that there are some things that are unfixable. And just trying to deal with that. Now, I understand for a lot of people watching that play, they couldn't get beyond the violence of it. And I don't see it as a particularly violent play. There's one scene where there's suggestion of something happening, but the lights go down before it happens. I suppose the Greeks would always have their deaths off stage, or mainly had them off stage. Shakespeare brought the deaths on stage. I would be an advocator of death on stage. I think there's something not much discussed, there's something beautiful about the act of dying, as long as it's not yourself, of course. But there is something aesthetically satisfying about seeing a death on stage, provided it's dealt with properly, or a mini death, which essentially is what happens at the end of Act One on Raftery's Hill. That point where actually your life is over, but you have to go on living.
I was Elaine in Marina Carr's Ariel, which was done in 2002 for the Abbey.
Actress Eileen Walsh.
It starts off with Ariel's 16th birthday. And at that point, my character Elaine is only like 10 or something like that. Elaine is Ariel's sister. The end of the first act is basically Ariel is murdered by her dad, sacrificed by her father, who was a TD, on the promise of becoming Taoiseach, say. And in the second act, the mother discovers that the father killed Ariel, so she kills the father. And then by the third act, I discover that my mother killed my father, so I kill my mother because I was always in love with my father. I think Marina's writing is incredibly dark and incredibly visceral, and, you know, she kind of pares everything down to our basest instincts, which makes it easy to play, I think, because even though everything is based in kind of Greek tragedy or, you know, kind of Greek stories or whatever, everything comes down to very small moments that we all understand. So even though you end up killing your mother because you were in love with your father, as kind of, you know, ridiculous as that seems, you think, well, I've been there. I've been in moments of hating my mother or hating somebody. And it's just about not being afraid of going with that and letting that explode and seeing how human emotion can really be animalistic.
My latest play, Woman and Scarecrow, is currently in rehearsals at the Abbey and will be performed at the Peacock fairly soon. Woman and Scarecrow is about a woman who is dying too young and is travelling back over certain moments, certain pivotal moments in her life, with the aid of this supernatural character, Scarecrow, who is an aspect of woman. So I suppose in a way it's a dialogue between self and soul, but that makes it sound more esoteric than it is, because it's not that at all. It's set in an imaginative space, yes, but there is a wicked aunt and there is a desperately remorseful husband also within that space, and they're all whirling around her and circling around her as she tries to come to terms and glean some redemption, some understanding, and try and stave off the terror that is encroaching, which I have manifested as this awful creature in the wardrobe who's closing in on her, which is death, essentially. So I suppose it's a deathbed aria, but it's also wickedly funny, according to me.
At the moment, I'm in rehearsals for Woman in Scarecrow. When I look back on the other work of Marina's that I did, what's really interesting about Woman in Scarecrow for me now is that it somehow unites the world of Woolaloo with a less abstract world. But the central relationship of the man and the woman, and this woman confined to a bed, which is in Woolaloo, it's interesting to see that coming back. And the female rage, which is developed from the May into By the Bog of Cats, is kind of split into two now, because it's expressed through woman and expressed through Scarecrow. The other interesting thing is that her language, if there's any location, it reaches towards the west of Ireland and Connemara and all that kind of thing, but it's not set in Connemara. I mean, it could be the Midlands, but there's no reference to that in the writing, and there's no dialect. Marina has said that there is a Connemara sound, but it's not at all as evident. Location is not at all as evident in this as it was in By the Bog of Cats or even in the May. You know, people don't talk about the male-female relationship quite so much in relation to Marina's plays as they do about the whole aspect of the female, but I think that's a really important part of her work. The woman in this play, as May in the May, and even Hester in By the Bog of Cats, the man, Carthage in Bob Cats, Robert in the May, and him in this, and the woman says it in this play, he was the closest I came to the thing itself.
How do I feel about being a female playwright? Initially, I used to hate that appendage, female playwright. You don't hear the male playwright. I'm kind of blue in the face saying this, I don't say it anymore. I mean, I just sit down in the morning and write, and that's what I do. And you get to the point, people are going to say what they think about you. They're going to have agendas. I have enough supporters, enough people who wish me well, and that keeps me going.
The playwright in profile was Marina Carr. The contributors were Dervla Crotty, Alwyn Fuere, Tom Hickey, Patrick Mason, Sarah Jane Skiff, and Eileen Walsh. The programme was compiled and presented by Sean Rocks, and the producer was Kevin Reynolds.